I think you'll agree with me that that was a most comprehensive address delivered very efficiently. We have 15 minutes for questions from the floor. Have we got any down the back there? No? Well, I might. Sorry, yes. Rick, in the middle there.
Premier, Irene Irvine from Deakin University. Premier, I'd like to ask a question about infrastructure, but a different sort of infrastructure, and that is knowledge infrastructure. Your government has been extremely generous in supporting innovation and education within the state. And through the Office of Knowledge Capital, you would be aware of just how much investment and return to Victoria, Victoria's universities make to the state and to the future viability of the state. You will also be aware there is an inquiry into the future of universities within Australia. Will your government be making a submission to that? And in particular, will you be making comments about the fact that on a per capita basis, in comparison to the OECD, Australia invests far less in the education of its universities than do other OECD nations? Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Irene. And I think, as you're aware, and I think you're kind enough to say, we have, for our part, as a state, made significant investments in areas that traditionally would have been the responsibility of the national government. And we've done that based around our university clusters. We've done that particularly based around the life sciences and the information technology industries. And as you know, at Deakin University, we played a key role in achieving the medical school there, and which is a great asset for Deakin University. We've obviously recently attracted Satium with their major investment in information technology onto that campus. We have significant investments too, as you know, in the life sciences. On top of that, as you're aware, recently in the US I announced the $50 million contribution that the state will make towards a new supercomputer, which will be based at Melbourne University. This is for the life sciences. And I mention it because it'll be the biggest supercomputer in the world devoted to life sciences. And this thing is 400 teraflops, 400 billion transactions per second. And it'll be here in Victoria. So it's bigger than much bigger than the computers at the Bureau, the biggest in Australia. And it's all part with the synchrotron and our partnership with the Commonwealth on the Stem Cell Centre of putting these investments in place around our universities. And so that knowledge agenda is very, very important to us. In relation to the federal government's review, we will be making a submission there. We will obviously be urging them to lift the investment which has been made in those areas. And as I indicated in my speech, the federal government in recent years has been doing too little in this space and needs to do more in the future. And I think you will see some benefits flowing from the $11 billion fund which the Rudd government announced in the budget.
Do we have another question?
Mark Ingram, Business for Millennium Development. Premier, the COAG water deal for the Murray-Darling, perhaps you could comment on whether you think this is going to proceed.
Sorry, Mark?
The COAG water deal? Yeah.
Well, I think it was, I said today and I said previously, I think it was a great outcome. And most importantly, we've in the Adelaide COAG, we agreed on the Memorandum of Understanding, so it's the first time everyone had agreed. And in the Sydney COAG, we actually signed the Intergovernmental Agreement. And for those of you who know a bit about these things, the devil is always in the detail, and it's always very challenging getting from the Memorandum to the Intergovernmental Agreement. So that's all signed, sealed and delivered, and what that means is that we now have a national framework for addressing needs in the Murray-Darling Basin. And over time, that national framework is what's going to deliver more water for the environment. And as I said today in my speech, the best way of achieving that in the medium and long term, in our view, is by investment in water-saving infrastructure. We've shown, for example, with the Wimmera-Mallee scheme, I said before, there's 100 billion litres of water released into that system every year, 90 billion litres is lost through evaporation mainly and some part seepage. And to give you an idea of how much water that is, if you built a channel 25 metres wide and a metre deep from here to Darwin, you have to go to there and back and fill it with water to get 90 billion litres. That's how much water is lost each year. That system is on 10% this year, but even at 10%, every farmer can get a full entitlement if all of the pipes in that system were completely sealed, if they will be by 2010. So the savings there are going back to farmers and back to the environment, and ditto with food bowl. So our view is the best way to resolve these issues in the medium and long term is with the right framework. We've got that. And then secondly, the significant investment in water-saving infrastructure, as we saw in COAG, as we're seeing with food bowl, as we're seeing with Wimmera-Mallee system. This is good for the regional economy, but it's also good for the environment because this is water that's been wasted, which is now available for growth and for the environment.
Premier, Negba Wise Dollar from Resurgence, a word that you used a few times, so thank you for that. You talked about the fact that we're experiencing the biggest population growth. So I wanted to ask you about another form of infrastructure, housing, both public and private. Your thoughts about how we could do something about that?
Well, I think on housing, a couple of observations. For the last 3 years, Victoria's led Australia in housing starts. So despite the fact that New South Wales has got more than a million more people than Victoria, we've led the way in housing starts, more than Queensland, obviously. And the HIA's predictions are that over the next 3 years, we will also lead Australia in housing starts. So the fundamentals, I think, we've got right. And we're in a very different position, say, to New South Wales, where they have very heavy charges on land development and property development, which means that it is very, very expensive to buy your first home. In Victoria, you can still get a house and land package, brand new home, for under $300,000. In fact, there are still places where you'll get one for $260,000, $280,000. So home entry levels are much more cost-effective in Victoria than they are in, I think, in all other states apart from Adelaide. Secondly, last year's budget, we announced a record commitment for public housing, $500 million extra, and I remember it, I was the Treasurer at the time. It's the largest ever one-off boost that we've made to public housing, and that was to address the fact that with the challenges on housing affordability, obviously many people simply can't afford to buy their own home. A third point I'd make, I think, on housing affordability is the recent reforms to planning, which Minister Justin Madden and I have announced, that they provide for less regulation in releasing housing blocks in the outer suburbs of Melbourne. There are now 5 outer urban growth zones, but as well in the inner and middle suburbs, the announcement of what we call development assessment committees, which are partnerships between the community, local government and the state, to fast-track the approvals of medium-density developments in activity centres. So that'll be good in terms of Melbourne 2030. And I think the final point I'd make is in the recent budget, we also cut stamp duty for home buyers buying up to $500,000, and again, very focused on that first home buyer market. So I think you put all of those things together in what is a very difficult environment for home buyers. I think we're doing more than any other state. And in turn, that's one of the reasons why we're getting such strong population growth, because people can come here and know that housing is more affordable than it is in New South Wales or Brisbane.
We have time for perhaps one or two. Oh, sorry.
I'll make my answer shorter.
Wes Fleming, passionate Victorian.
Well done, Wes, too, on your recent achievement.
Thank you. The question I would like to put to yourself is to do with our public open space. And that it's across Victoria or across Melbourne now that the canopy cover from private land is reducing by 5% annually. 5% is a large number across 10 years. I'd like to know the government's position on public open space going forward, because it does have a twofold benefit, not just for the environment, but also for social implications. And the Victorian government going forward, there's there seems to be little emphasis now on public open space and the development of that to enhance climate change, to go a long way to meeting Kyoto targets. So, yeah, just a question on public open space.
Right. Well, I think public open space is very important, and it's a key element of our livability and quality of life. And you know, we all remember the old days, going back to Dick Hamer, the Garden State, and of course the number plates, you can still, of course, have that. And so it's very important to our quality of life and livability. I would disagree with the basis of your thesis. There's no evidence that I'm aware of to suggest that public open space is declining. And in fact, there have been significant additions to the state park estate over recent years since we've been in government, both to metropolitan parks and to national parks in country Victoria. So in fact, I saw some figures the other day that suggest that there's been almost a doubling of park area. So that's the first point. The second point is when you actually look at open space in new property developments, there's no more or no less than there's been in the past in terms of suburban development. What is occurring, though, and I know this because we have a discussion with the sports minister about this, is that in fact in terms of the open space which is there's actually more which is, quote, open space, that's creeks, walking areas, bike tracks, and there's probably a little less for sports grounds and ovals, and there's a few planning reasons why that occurs. So if the sports minister was here today, he'd say he'd like more of that open space for sports ovals, and we're having a bit of a look at that in government at the moment. But there's no evidence I've seen that suggests there's any reduction, and in fact, if you get the advice, as you know, from DSE and other departments, in all of the new areas that have been developed, there are quite stringent rules in relation to native vegetation offsets,
yep.
Which sometimes property developers complain about.
Well, I suppose to clarify that, it was in private, the canopy cover in private areas has been reducing. My concern is that we are getting a lot more or public open space currently, but it's underutilised. When we look at the role that green life plays within our society, even by becoming windbreaks, by lessening the wind effect on heating and cooling in our homes, we can actually lessen power use within our homes by up to 20%. And yet our public open space is not being given any greater emphasis than it has been in the past, even though our blocks are getting smaller privately and our houses are getting bigger. So there is no room for canopy cover anymore within the private domain. It all has to come from public, be that street or park. And yet I don't think we've had any greater emphasis on those areas. Yes, we are having a few more parks being put aside, but within the urban area where we live, 87% of us live in the urban area.
So I'm happy.
Our urban areas are becoming less healthy.
Yep. So I'm happy to get some advice on what's happening in the private areas. So I've had advice in the public land areas, in the private areas. I think one of the other things in recent years, obviously, is just we've had, 5 out of 6 years have been very dry.
That's right.
And we've had water restrictions, so it's been a difficult environment to grow shrubs or trees in people's yards. And that'll change in the future when our water projects are complete and we have more water security. I think the other thing in an environment of climate change and emissions trading, where there's a price on carbon, growing trees, certainly in country areas, and vegetation, will be something which is very much encouraged. And in fact, with a price for carbon, you'll see many carbon sinks created and large-scale revegetation occurring in many of those areas. So whether that'll do the job as far as you're concerned, I'm not sure, but I'm happy to have a look at the issue.
Thank you.
One more question over here.
Thank you very much. Mr. Premier, Griff Davis from the City of Whittlesea.
Yep.
I note the comment that you made earlier on in relation to the Eddington report, where you said that you anticipated decisions being made about those recommendations towards the end of the year. Can you explain the relationship between the decisions coming out of the Eddington report and also in terms of priorities and funding priorities, and those coming from the Meredith Sussex work on the Metropolitan Transport Plan? Do they relate to each other, or are they being dealt with as a separate entity?
They're essentially exactly the same things. So So what's occurred, we received the Eddington report, and as you're aware, and as I mentioned in my speech today, and we've encouraged debate about the Eddington report, which is a good thing, because there are many very significant and far-reaching proposals, and to some people they're quite controversial proposals. So we've encouraged debate, and that's a good thing. That debate finishes on July 15 in terms of the opportunity for public consultations. There's a online dialogue this Friday, and I encourage people to use that and submit their views. So we've had 500 submissions, as I said in my speech. So one of the judgments the government had to make was, would we rule out any proposals that were put to government that were outside the scope of Eddington? Right? And we had to make that judgment. And the judgment we made was that at this stage we should not rule those out. So you saw the debate yesterday about an outer ring road and the missing link. These are proposals which have been put to the government by various groups. RACV, for example, has a strong view in relation to missing link and outer ring road. So we have to make a judgment, would we consider these projects and not rule them out automatically? So we've made a judgment that we're not ruling anything out, and we are prepared to look at a whole raft of projects which go to the future transport needs of both Melbourne and more broadly Victoria. So we have a cabinet subcommittee, which I chair, which has half a dozen ministers on it. The executive officer who is responsible for that is Meredith Sussex. We are meeting twice a week at the moment, so we're putting in a huge amount of work on this, and we expect to have a final all-of-government decision on Eddington Plus, if I could use that expression, by the end of the year.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Premier. I'd now ask that Brett Thomas join us to move a vote of thanks.
Thanks, Andrew. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and to CEDA. We're very honoured today to be able to give this vote of thanks to the Premier on behalf of CEDA, the sponsors of today, and all the attendees that have participated here as well. For Acciona, it's an important time for us, I guess, springboarding off Nadal's win in Wimbledon and the recent Euro Cup win of Spain. We feel very proud to be sponsoring an address that's looking at challenges of the future. We've heard today a very interesting and very detailed discussion of the challenges that we face. Clearly, they're substantial. Issues of climate change, issues of infrastructure growth, issues of hospital, medical, housing, and those sorts of matters have all been addressed. And it's very clear that the government has a good handle on the issues that it's needing to address and has taken some specific steps to look at those within the context of the challenges we face of credit crisis, of climate change, and of transportation and water diminishing infrastructure over the years. I think the actions that have been taken around regulatory reform, around infrastructure funding, around some of the human capital development, some of the social infrastructure work that's been taken by the government have been exemplary, and I think it'll be congratulated. Probably in summary, I hark back to watching a little bit of the television footage of the Premier in the football papers, and I noted in the first ball that was kicked out to the Premier that under a fair bit of pressure and a fair bit of challenge, the ball wasn't quite cleanly picked up. But what was very encouraging was that in the second ball that came through to the Premier, he did get in front, he did address the challenge, did take the mark and kick the ball on. So I think that's a great sign for the future, and we congratulate the Premier on today and also on that mark.